This is All In. I'm Miriam Sob. No Compact of Silence, an exhibit at the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site, will open next week. The exhibit aims to highlight local and national Black activists. With us now are some folks involved in the project, Jennifer Capps, VP of Curatorship and Exhibition at the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site, and Kelly Poston, Curatorial Fellow at the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site. Welcome to both of you. Thank you for joining us. Kelly, I'll start with you. How did you get involved in this effort? I understand you're heading up this exhibit.
Mm-hmm. So I am currently a grad student at IUPUI in the Museum Studies program. And in your second and final year, all of the students, we are placed in a museum here in Indianapolis to gain real life experience. So each student is required to interview at a couple of the different museums, and then we pick the one that we felt most engaged with. So luckily for me, I loved the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site when I interviewed with Jennifer Capps. And one of my duties was to build the exhibit. So that was my role, and that's what I've been working on for the past 6 months or so.
When you say that your role is to build this exhibit, what does that involve? Does it mean researching, finding artifacts? I mean, I'm just guessing off the top of my head here.
No, absolutely. So in August, I sat down with Jennifer and Charlie Hyde. He's our president at the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site. And we started just brainstorming what we wanted to present in our exhibit. So we brought in a lot of different ideas and started thinking about past exhibits that we've put on, as well as new topics we haven't covered before. So we started to look at Black civil rights advocates and people that Benjamin Harrison was involved with, as well as Indiana local activists. So when building this exhibit, I went with that idea, and then that entailed doing all the research on these figures, contacting museums that were dedicated to these figures, as well as historians and people that had information on them. From there, that branched into looking for artifacts that happened during this time. During the 1890s, people weren't really collecting any type of artifacts connected to civil rights, but that doesn't take away from the amazing research that was done. And once I had all the information, then I worked alongside Jennifer to put the panels together and get the exhibit up and ready for everyone to see.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And it's making me think of a lot more questions that I want to ask. But first, I want to ask Jennifer, if you can tell us about how this exhibit fits in with the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site.
Sure. We always try in our exhibits to, you know, tie into Benjamin Harrison and kind of his legacy and history. So this certainly ties into his stand on, you know, civil rights and trying and voting rights and all of that. So again, we're looking at his time period and kind of the activists at that time. So it certainly ties into our mission and promoting, you know, civil rights, promoting being active in your government is something that's very important for Benjamin Harrison as well. So definitely ties into our mission and all of the efforts that we try to do here at the site.
I'm not going to try to speak for everyone, but I think many of us don't tie, I don't know, Indiana, Benjamin Harrison, or any of these things to civil rights type of work. Is that something that you come across often? Are people really surprised to learn that there were efforts being made?
Yes, I think, you know, it is not something that is widely known, you know, in Benjamin Harrison's history, or again, some of the advocates that Kelly has found to point out and highlight in this exhibit, especially the local ones, are not names that are as well known as they should be.
And Kelly, can you tell us a little bit about some of those folks?
Sure. So we focus on three of our main national figures. So we're looking at Ida B. Wells, Frederick Douglass, and Blanche Kelso Bruce. Ida B. Wells and Frederick Douglass, they led campaigns on Black civil rights, anti-lynching movements, and Black citizens finding their place in America when there was a lot of pushback during that time. We then are focused on a lot of Indiana activists, like Jennifer said, that I had never heard of before, but are here to celebrate their lives and learn all these wonderful things. So we have these great Indiana activists like William D. McCoy. He was appointed by Benjamin Harrison to be the Minister and Consul General of Liberia. We have people like Catherine Flossie Bailey, who she worked to instate a safer and more protective anti-lynching law here in Indiana in 1931. And then we have just great educators. William D. McCoy started out as a teacher. Sally Stewart, Lillian Thomas Fox, all these people were teaching and being journalists and talking about where their places in society and how voting suppression, lynchings, all of these things were putting them at a disadvantage and that they had to stop. So it's a really great exhibit to celebrate these national figures that we've learned about in school and then getting a more in-depth learning about their experiences and their lives, as well as looking at all of these Indiana activists who hopefully by the end of this exhibit, people will be proud that they were here in Indiana, but also to raise their names up in the years to come.
Voter suppression, unfortunately, is not something new, and it seems to keep making a comeback. Did you think about that when you were planning this exhibit, or was that just something that happened to come together?
One major point of the exhibit that I, Jennifer, Charlie, and Whitney all worked on is we put up a timeline of civil rights throughout history, starting with the Civil War. As space was available, we couldn't go all the way to present day. But we did research all of these things that were happening in current day and how they reflect even in the 1890s, these are still happening today. So we were just actively thinking about these conversations and how hopefully people looking at the exhibit will be like, this isn't so different from today. What can we do? How can we be a Black civil rights advocate in today's time?
Well, if you're just joining us, we're looking into the life of former U.S. President Benjamin Harrison, the only U.S. president to come out of the state of Indiana. We're talking with Jennifer Capps, VP of Curatorship and Exhibition at the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site, and Kelly Poston, Curatorial Fellow at the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site, about an exhibit launching next week. If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Jennifer, when it comes to this exhibit, is this unique to the presidential site, or do you often have exhibits about topics like this?
Well, normally we have two exhibit spaces here at the site that are changing exhibit spaces. So they vary, I'll say, greatly from year to year as to what we focus on. So we have in the past, I'll say, touched upon Benjamin Harrison and Frederick Douglass and their connections, but this is certainly the deeper dive, I'll say, into this particular subject matter with, you know, again, civil rights at that time period, voting rights. And I'll just mention real quickly here as we were sort of wrapping up with voting, again, a quote from Benjamin Harrison from one of his annual addresses was, when and under what conditions is the Black man to have a free ballot? When is he, in fact, to have all of those full civil rights which have so long been his in law? So, again, just that importance to Harrison to bring that up in his time period. And as you mentioned, you know, obviously coincidence or history, you know, repeating itself somewhat to speak, that is still a topic today that is current in events as well.
Kelly, did you learn things you didn't know as you were putting this together? Were you surprised by anything?
The thing that most surprised me is how it does. It's almost a clear reflection of what was happening in the 1890s. Learning a lot about these activists and things that they're doing and the impacts that are happening. Major Taylor, he's a local Indiana native. He was known to be the first Black world champion cyclist here in the U.S. And all of the things he was doing, where he wasn't actively speaking about this until later in his life, but being in those spaces, taking a part of those races, all of those type of things was showing his activism. And learning about how all of that is impacting biking clubs around the nation still, and how his exhibits are going up in multiple museums here in Indianapolis as well, of learning about how their lives in the 1890s are still being shown and reflected in today's time as well.
And Jennifer, before we get ready to wrap up here, how important is it for us to look back at history in order to understand the present?
Well, I think it is very important to kind of know what has happened in history in previous years, and it definitely lays those footholds, those ground steps for proceeding forward. And hopefully, you know, learning from the past and you know, looking at where we started at and where we're headed in the future, and hopefully coming to, you know, better conclusions by evaluating, you know, what has happened in the past. So we, again, promote a lot of different things here at the site and try to encourage everyone to, again, look at what has happened and what we are trying to do, promoting civic involvement and voting and all of those things as the future goes on.
And when can folks see this exhibit exactly? I know it's running for a few months or for the year.
Yeah, so it opens on the 27th, next week on Thursday, Thursday evening, and will run through November of this year.
All right, and anyone can attend this exhibit, or do they have to be members?
You do not have to be a member, and in fact, actually, this exhibit will be out in the Welcome Center, the Carriage House Welcome Center, that is a part of the property where you actually go in to check for starting a tour, but actually the exhibit is in a free space here at the site.
All right. Well, thank you both so much for joining us. We appreciate your time, Jennifer and Kelly. Jennifer Capps, VP of Curatorship and Exhibition at the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site, and Kelly Poston, Curatorial Fellow at the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site. Coming up, we'll be joined by an author who's written a biography about Benjamin Harrison. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We've been talking about a new exhibit coming to the Benjamin Harrison Presidential Site that highlights Black activists of that era. To learn more now about Benjamin Harrison, we're going to dig into his life and history with Ray Boomhauer, author of Mr. President, A Life of Benjamin Harrison. It's part of the Youth Biography series. Boomhauer is also senior editor at the Indiana Historical Society Press. Welcome back, Ray.
Glad to be with you today.
All right, let's start with probably an obvious question. What drew you to write a biography about Benjamin Harrison?
I hadn't known a lot about Benjamin Harrison, I must admit, before I wrote his biography. I had had a great interest in the politics of his era, the Gilded Age and Progressive Era, you know, the 1880s to the 1920s, particularly Indiana's key role in a lot of those national elections. And of course, Harrison is the only president from Indiana, elected as the 23rd president in 1888. But when I started doing work on his life and also his time as president, I became more and more impressed by his achievements in office. If you ask a lot of political scientists or historians of the presidency, you will find that in national polls, his time in office ranks somewhere in the middle or below average. I think there's a growing consensus that he was a better president, a better chief executive than a lot of people know about. When he took over the presidency in 1893, the Republican Party, of which he was part, controlled both houses of Congress. And so during his first 2 years in office, Congress passed a lot of substantial legislation. In fact, the 51st Congress passed more than 530 measures during its 2 years in existence and passed a lot of what Harrison had run on when he was campaigning against the incumbent Grover Cleveland, the Democrat, including increased pensions for veterans of the Civil War, raising the tariff, which was passed as McKinley Tariff Act, to protect trade and commerce from monopolies. The Sherman Antitrust Act was passed. And also in the Forest Reserve Act for the first time, he had authority as president to set aside forest reserves from land in the public domain. And millions of acres were saved because of that act. And as you talked about previously, there was a fight on behalf of civil rights for African Americans, Henry Cabot Lodge passed a reform act to have the national government oversee congressional elections, which would really help, and also voting in the southern states. So African Americans would finally have the right to vote in those states.
Well, why do you think not enough people know about him? And I'm basing this again, maybe I'm just basing it on myself, though. Like, I didn't know this much about history in Indiana and its ties to having a president. Is it because his term was so short and so maybe there wasn't a lot of drama?
You have to face a basic fact. You know, if you're a one-term president, if you don't get reelected, you're obviously seen as a failure because the voters decided to go with someone else. For example, Jimmy Carter, who's better known now for being an ex-president than a president. But in Harrison's case, unfortunately, the massive spending of the 51st Congress, the Democratic opponents called it the billion-dollar Congress, and the Speaker of the House, Thomas Reitz, well, you know, this is a billion-dollar country, so defended what his party had done. But it was seen, all the activity was seen as an overreach, and so during the midterm congressional elections, Democrats took over power in the Congress, and so a lot of what Harrison wanted to do during his final years in office was stymied. Also, his personality sometimes worked against him. He was known as cold and aloof, even to his supporters. And something he realized about himself, he was known as the Indiana Icicle. And even members of his own party sometimes were angry with him about not giving in to their patronage request, putting their friends in office. Harrison sometimes opposed that. And he was, you know, not seen as a cordial man, even by his friends. But he had very fine oratorical skills and did better in speaking to the audience and then in meeting them afterwards. And his friends knew this about him. In fact, one of them, John C. New, knew he was going to go off to give a speech in Indiana somewhere for on behalf of the Republican Party. And before he left town, he advised him, you know, "Now, Ben, I know you'll capture them with your speech, but for God's sakes, be a human being down there. Mix around a little with the boys after the meeting." But a few days after he got back in town, Harrison said to him, "John, I tried, but I failed. I'll never try again. I just must be myself." His close friends
knew. Sounds like he was a little bit of an introvert.
He was. And people forget also that he was a very activist president. He was very hands-on. He worked very hard in office. He worked with members of his own party to get the legislation passed in Congress, hosting receptions and dinners at the executive mansion to kind of schmooze legislative leaders. He started his day early at 8 o'clock. And worked throughout the day with a very small staff. When you consider all the help that modern day presidents have, he had a lot on his shoulders as a president. And more so because a lot of details came to him because some of his key cabinet secretaries were ill during his time in office. And one senator from Kansas said that Harrison was probably the only man who served as president capable of discharging with real ability the duty of every one of his cabinet ministers, and probably was the best equipped man for public office he had ever seen. But all these details of his administration did weigh on him from time to time. And I think that's also something that he was not sad to leave the White House when he was defeated 4 years, in the next election by Grover Cleveland, who took over presidency once again.
Well, I want to go back a little and get into Benjamin Harrison's early days. Where was he born? How did he end up in Indiana? I realize there's a lot that happened in between his birth and settling here in Indiana. So if we could just start with the early days.
Sure. He was born in Ohio on August 20th, 1833. And from the first, he seemed almost destined for higher things, for some kind of life in politics, because after all, His father, John Scott Harrison, was a two-term congressman from Ohio. He was the grandson of William Henry Harrison, the first governor of the Indiana Territory and then the ninth president of the United States. And even the great-grandson of Benjamin Harrison V, who was a governor of Virginia and a signer of the Declaration of Independence. So he seemed destined for greater things even when he was a young man. But he grew up in Ohio, attended Farmers College, and later graduated from Miami University. And someone with a strong Christian faith instilled in him by his mother, Elizabeth Harrison. He kept his Presbyterian faith until his death in 1901. Met and married a young woman named Carolyn Scott, who he met while attending Miami University, and decided to enter the profession of law, which kind of goes hand in hand with politics. Those days, you didn't go to law school. You read law in a fellow attorney's office. And so he read law in the firm of Storer and Gwynne. And in 1854, was admitted to the bar and decided to look for opportunities elsewhere. Cincinnati was too crowded. He thought about going to Chicago with his young wife, but decided instead to settle here in Indianapolis and open up his law practice. He was encouraged to do so by a cousin of his who told him that there was a lot of opportunities for a young go-getting man like himself in this Western city, as it was known at that time. And so he came here, had tough sledding early on in his law career, was lucky to earn a couple dollars here and there, but really started making a name for himself when he formed a law partnership in 1855 with William Wallace, who was the brother of Lew Wallace, best known today as the author of Ben-Hur, the famous novelist, and prospered in his law practice. And really made a name for himself, got involved with Republican politics, and became well known as a speaker on behalf of the party, went across the state giving speech after speech. And people could always remember how well he did when he did his stump speeches and how deeply engaged he seemed when he was speaking. One person described it as his face pale and tense, the blue eyes blue and piercing, the voice incisive and penetrating, and the words charged with thought and feeling and conviction, until at last he made an appeal which moved men to action. So he became a rising star in Republican politics before the outbreak of the Civil War here in the Hoosier State.
If you have any questions or comments for the show today, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Ray Boomhauer, author of Mr. President, A Life of Benjamin Harrison. It's part of the Youth Biography Series. Boomhauer is also senior editor at the Indiana Historical Society Press. We're getting into the background of President Benjamin Harrison. Ray, Harrison had lots of connections to politics through his own family. Did that influence him to get involved, or was this something that he had to come up with on his own? Like, did he use family connections to get him to where he wanted to go?
It helped him, of course. You know, William Henry Harrison was well-regarded in Indiana because of his time as territorial governor. And there was something about Harrison himself. He was a go-getter. He told a friend once that the overall ruling characteristic of his life was a real determination to succeed in spite of every human obstacle. He said that a faint heart never did anything worthy of a man. He realized he had a leg up on a lot of people because of his famous name, but there's probably an apocryphal story about some of his Republican friends pulling him out of his law office one day to speak to a political gathering. And he was introduced to the crowd, of course, as the grandson of Old Tippecanoe, William Henry Harrison. But in his talk, he said, I want to understand that I am the grandson of nobody. I believe that every man should stand on his own merits. And achieving fame and fortune in him would only be truly honorable and desirable if he could earn it himself. And a close acquaintance later asked him if he had ever even seriously thought of becoming president like his grandfather. And Harrison has said that the thought had been with him many times when suggested by others, but that he had never been possessed by it or had his life shaped by it. But he did use his family name and entered Indiana politics. I think he was also helped by the fact that he did fight for the Union cause during the Civil War. In July 1862, Indiana's governor, Oliver Morton, asked him to recruit men for the 70th Indiana Volunteer Infantry Regiment. And Harrison, served the Union cause, rose to become colonel of the regiment, and was well thought of by his men. Harrison was not particularly tall, even for the time. He was only 5'6", and he receives the nickname Little Ben from his men, and earned a reputation as a tough guy, had tough discipline in his regiment, but also seen as a fair taskmaster, who knew that idleness was waste and that civilians don't become soldiers by just putting on a uniform, but needed discipline. He was someone who gave sterling service for the Union cause, marched with General William Tecumseh Sherman to capture Atlanta, and even during 1 month in fighting, saw more action than his grandfather had seen during his entire military service. So someone who saw shot and shell, saw men being wounded very seriously, and someone for the rest of his life thought that his service in the Civil War was very important to him. He spoke at reunion meetings of the Grand Army of the Republic and said that he saw his no higher honor than to be called a comrade by the survivor of those who saved the Union.
How much did his involvement in the Civil War influence his life?
Quite a bit. I think it's really helped him in GOP circles in the Republican Party following the war. Became part of his political life, something that he used in his campaigns against the Democrats, waved the bloody shirt as the GOP did in the years after the Civil War. And he found success in politics. He did lose a run for governor, but was selected by the Indiana legislature to serve as a United States senator from Indiana, and rose that fame to be to win nomination for the presidency at the 1888 Republican Convention. It was quite a time in Indianapolis. There was a lot of celebration when Harrison won the nomination. Large crowds, when they heard the news, trooped down to his law office, gathered outside his home on North Delaware Street, cheering and shouting, and in fact, took away a lot of his fence as souvenirs because of his success in winning the nomination. And it was a different time in politics in those days. If you were a presidential candidate, you weren't going out crisscrossing the country, giving speeches touting your candidacy. In fact, Grover Cleveland, the incumbent president, stayed in the White House because it was seen as unseemly for a president to go out on the husk and ask people for their votes. Harrison himself said that, he had a real chance of meeting fools if he stayed at home, but he was sure to meet them if he went out on the campaign trail. So he decided to stay in Indianapolis. And instead of him going out to the voters came to him. They would take the trains and come to Indianapolis. And Harrison, they would come to his home at first, and he would greet various delegations. Later, the crowds became too much to handle, and they decided to give speeches at University Park. And he gave 80 talks to more than 300,000 visitors.
Well, we'll be back in just a moment to continue our conversation on the first and only U.S. president to come out of Indiana, Benjamin Harrison. We're speaking with historian Ray Boomhauer. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're continuing our conversation with Ray Boomhauer, author of Mr. President, A Life of Benjamin Harrison. Boomhauer is the senior editor at the Indiana Historical Society Press. Ray, before the break, you mentioned how Benjamin Harrison had given about 80 talks to some 300,000 people. One thing that I was wondering, aside from his achievements and political career, was it common to find someone like him that, from what I'm hearing from his story, it sounds like he was pretty modest about his achievements and wanting to do things on his own terms, and even initially wasn't interested in becoming president. Was that an unusual characteristic for someone of that time?
I believe so. A lot of voters and a lot of people who supported the Democrat and the Republican Party wanted in their candidate someone who seemed high, above the office. Someone who wouldn't worry about the grind of daily politics, but was a little above the fray. Politics was very important in American society in the 19th century. You had very strong ties to each party. And during this time period in the 1880s, particularly the 1888 election, it was very close between the two parties. The Democrats could rely on the solid South following the Civil War, of course, with this restrictive Jim Crow legislation. Democrats controlled a lot of the Confederate states, and Republicans really had no chance to win those states in the presidential elections. So it all came down to a few key states, including Ohio, New York, and Indiana. And that's why between 1840 and 1920, you see a lot of Indiana politicians on national party tickets for both Republicans and the Democrat. Most of the time, vice presidencies, but in Harrison's case, he took over as the presidential candidate for the GOP in that 1888 election. And just the closeness of the politics at that time can be seen in the results of that election. Harrison won the Electoral College, 233-168. He barely squeaked by and won his home state as well as New York. But he lost the popular vote to Cleveland, the incumbent. And so it was the third of five elections where you saw the popular vote winner actually lose an Electoral College. The first one came when Andrew Jackson in 1824, Samuel Tilden in 1875, Harrison in 1888, and then the more modern ones, contemporary ones, Al Gore won the popular vote in 2000, and Hillary Clinton won the popular vote in 2016. Of course, if voters were, you know, white males or black males at that time. Women could not vote in the 1888 election. But if you were eligible to vote, you went out and voted. And in the 1888 election, nearly 80% of the population eligible to vote did so. In contrast that with more modern times, in 2016, 49% of those eligible voted, and that raised up to 57% in 2020. So politics is really a spectator sport and something that a lot of people were more than happy to engage in during the 19th century.
Yeah, it certainly seems that it was more of a community effort and I don't know, entertainment maybe on some form for folks to see who was going to win and who wasn't.
There was a lot of chicanery involved as well, mm-hmm. particularly in that 1880 election. There's a lot of controversy over what was called the floating vote. And these were voters who could be induced by either direct bribery or a bottle of whiskey to sell their vote. And so that happened a lot in the 1888 election. And there's a big controversy about it because of a letter that a Republican official, William Dudley, sent about, you know, making sure to round up the voters in blocks of five and make sure that they don't get away so that the Democrats can grab their votes.
I mean, I wonder, you know, for them to get folks to vote for them for a bottle of whiskey is any different from today where politicians try to convince folks to vote for them because they promise a certain cause.
That could be true. You're promising things to get people to vote for your side. Luckily, today we have the secret ballot because back in those elections, political parties controlled the ballot to make sure that once you bought a voter, he stayed bought. So you could actually see him slip the ballot for your party into the ballot box. But after a lot of the controversy over that blocks of five letter and other things, there was a big movement post 1888 to have the secret ballot. And actually one was passed in Indiana, thanks to an Indiana historian named Jacob Pye Dunn Jr. And that became the way that the state, the actual government controlled how someone voted as opposed to the political parties themselves.
Something that we spoke about earlier with the guests about the presidential site and the exhibit that's coming up about Black activists during that time. The mention of the statement that President Benjamin Harrison made that he didn't want to push back against the voting rights of the Black community. Did he do anything else to push for equity and equality? I mean, was this unusual at the time for a president to take a stance?
He took a very strong stance when it came to African-American voting rights. And during his administration, of course, there was the effort to pass the Lodge bill. There was also another bill that Harrison supported for federal funding of educational institutions. And it would be given not only to white schools, but also to Black schools. Unfortunately, that was one of the measures like the Lodge bill that did not pass. One of the failures of the Harrison administration was seeing both of those measures go down to defeat.
And for the second term that he lost, what was that? What ultimately led to the loss?
There were a lot of factors going into Harrison's eventual loss in running again against the Democrat Grover Cleveland. There was a lot of unrest as far as strikes going on in Western states and a lot of other industries at the time that was causing unrest, a lot of battles between workers and their bosses when it came to getting unions organized. A lot of unrest in Western states, seeing that the Republican administration had not done enough for their causes. There was some unrest among some top GOP officials as well. There were people, leading Republican officials, who did not like Harrison and wanted someone else to be the nominee for the 1892 election. Harrison himself had a lot of anxiety going on. Now he was working too hard, and unfortunately his wife, Carolyn, was ill with tuberculosis that would eventually take her life before the election. And so he had a lot of things weighing on his mind, but he decided to persevere and actually run again, saying, you know, telling one friend that no Harrison has ever retreated in the presence of a foe without giving battle. And so I have determined to stand and fight. But all these problems in his party, problems in the country, led to his defeat at the ballot box. And he lost both in the Electoral College and also in the popular vote. He even lost his home state of Indiana, such a pivotal state, as well as New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. He didn't seem too upset about his defeat, telling someone that his defeat was no more surprising to Cleveland than it was to him. For me, there is no sting in it. Indeed, after the heavy blow the death of my wife dealt me, I do not think I could have stood the strain a re-election would have brought. So he was more than happy to leave Washington and return to his home in Indianapolis.
There are some quotes that I was reading that really intrigued me that he had said throughout his life. It almost seems like he wasn't from that era, or maybe he could see the future. I don't know. Things like, we Americans have no commission from God to police the world. That's a really interesting statement, in my opinion.
That is, and particularly given his own role in a lot of foreign policy. He was really someone who saw America as a force in the world. And even before leaving office, he had looked at hopefully annexing Hawaii, something that he wanted the government to do. But that was nixed later by the Cleveland administration. During his term in office, he modernized the American Navy, adding more battleships to modern battleships to our fleet. Wasn't afraid to shake the big stick, as Teddy Roosevelt would say, particularly when it came to an incident in Chile where some American sailors were arrested and beaten up in a bar fight that almost led to the brink of war between the two countries. But Harrison was diplomatic enough to end that conflict peacefully. So he was someone who was more than happy to use the power of the presidency and really set the stage for the more modern presidency that you would see in future administrations, including William McKinley and Teddy Roosevelt.
Another quote that caught my attention was where he says, "We cannot afford in America to have any discontented classes, and if fair wages are paid for fair work, we will have none." I mean, that sounds like common sense, but it sounds like a problem that's been in existence since the beginning of time.
And one that probably won't be solved while we're around.
Right. And so, I mean, was he concerned about, I mean, were these some of his biggest concerns while he was in office, making sure that folks can vote, that people are paid fair wages?
He was a pro-business Republican, but someone who was clear-eyed about it. He said he saw no sense in, paying workers so low wages that they couldn't afford to live. So they wanted to see equity between the working class and the business class. Someone who was always worried about fairness, someone who was always seen as honest in all his dealings while in office. There was really no big scandals that blackened his administration during his 4 years in office. And he's someone who I always have high regard for because kind of like Harry Truman, a lot of ex-presidents can go, they go off to big cities or big law firms, or they go out speaking engagements around the country. But Harrison, like Truman, returned to his hometown. Truman went back to Independence, and Harrison came back here to Indianapolis. And someone during that time, there was not a pension for ex-presidents. So he had to go back to his law practice and earn a living that way.
Yeah, it's unusual probably in our time now to see folks who reach the highest office then just go back to obscurity. Maybe it's impossible nowadays.
He kept busy. He had his law practice. He served as a trustee for Purdue University, wrote a series of articles for the Ladies' Home Journal, and also he really was a well-regarded lawyer. That's something that a lot of people don't know about Harrison. In fact, the Republic of Venezuela hired him in a border dispute that country had with Great Britain. And although he did yeoman work on behalf of the cause of Venezuela, an international court ruled on behalf of Great Britain, and he did lose that case.
Before we get ready to wrap up in a couple of minutes here, why is it important to learn about Harrison's life and legacy?
I think it's important because he's someone who chose Indiana to live. He came here and made a great contribution to the state's history and to our country's history as well. He had a lot of qualities that we should admire in any politician. His honesty, he was forthright in all his dealings with people. He might have been seen as a cold fish by some of his colleagues at the time, but was someone who always did what he thought was right for his country and for his state.
Do you think Indiana has the chance to put forward another U.S. president?
That's always a possibility. We seem to be, unfortunately, the mother of vice presidents. the two most most current ones are Dan Quayle and Mike Pence. So we always seem to be the bridesmaid and never the bride post-Harrison.
Well, before we let you go, I'm curious to know what some of your favorite parts of Harrison's story are that stuck out to you.
Most favorite parts were... A lot of it were his courtship with his wife, Carolyn, who I haven't talked about a lot here. Carolyn was quite more outgoing than her husband was. There's stories of their courtship where they're going to parties and Carolyn loved to dance and Benjamin did not. But Carolyn also played a big role in really improving the living conditions in the executive mansion, what we call the White House today. It was really... falling apart. There were rats everywhere. And thanks to her efforts, Congress did allocate some money to do some renovations to the White House, which she oversaw and really improved the conditions for the family members of the presidential family that occupied the executive mansion after the Harrisons left.
And I guess we will wrap up here, and we look forward to connecting with you again on more topics. Ray, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Always great to talk to you.
Ray Boomhauer is author of Mr. President, A Life of Benjamin Harrison, as part of the Youth Biography series. He's also senior editor at the Indiana Historical Society Press. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. You can always leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.